Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, and dedicated to the proposition articulated by Walter Lippmann during World War II that a strong and balanced foreign policy is the necessary shield of our democratic republic. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, and an occasional contributor to the Bulwark. And I'm rejoined this week by my partner in crime, Elliot Cohen, the Robert E. Osgood Professor of Strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and the Arleigh Burke Chair of Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Elliot, how was the conference on the future of maritime conflict at Basin Harbor in Vermont?
Well, the topic was really grim, and we had all kinds of dark views from military and naval officers, intelligence officials, and industry. But it's hard to get really too upset when you're sitting on the shores of Lake Champlain. Although it did give me an opportunity to hold forth on one of the topics I'm not sure I've discussed often enough with you, and that is the extent to which Benedict Arnold was really a much misunderstood and maligned figure in American history, who was responsible for an incredible fighting retreat from Valcour Island in 1776, but I digress.
Somehow I knew we would get to Benedict Arnold since you'd been up there. I'm actually happy to introduce our two guests today. They're very special guests because both of them have been colleagues in government, and one of them is my current colleague on the Defense Policy Board. We're joined today by Richard Fontaine, the CEO of the Center for New American Security, CNAS. He's been a staffer at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He's been an associate director for Near East Affairs and the National Security Council staff in Bush 43. He's worked in the Office of the Deputy Secretary of State in the South Asia Bureau at the Department of State, and was deputy staff director at the Senate Armed Services Committee, where he was an advisor to John McCain after having also done that in 2008 during the presidential campaign. And as well, we're joined by one of my most distinguished Foreign Service colleagues, who was a colleague of mine in government over multiple periods for at least 20 years, Ambassador Robert Blackwell, who is the Henry Kissinger Senior Fellow for U.S. Foreign Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. He has served in the Foreign Service in Nairobi and London and Tel Aviv, where he was the political counselor shortly before I arrived in my very first assignment. And he's been the principal deputy assistant secretary for political military affairs in the State Department, principal deputy assistant secretary for European affairs. He's been a director for Western Europe and the National Security Council under Jimmy Carter, and was the negotiator of the Mutual Balanced Force Reduction negotiations, where he had the rank of ambassador in the Reagan administration, and then was the senior director for Europe and Soviet affairs in the Bush 41 administration, and later served as ambassador to India and deputy national security advisor and envoy to Iraq. He's also been the associate dean and a senior faculty member at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Welcome to both of you, Richard Fontaine and Ambassador Bob Blackwell.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Eric. Thanks for having us.
So the two of you are on the show, not just because you're great colleagues, but because you've just written a new book, Lost Decade, the U.S. Pivot to Asia and the Rise of Chinese Power, which I think it's fair to say is probably the most thorough reconstruction of the so-called pivot to Asia that is in existence right now. Could the two of you describe for our listeners and viewers what the pivot actually was? What was the pivot?
Well, I'll kick it off, and Richard will perhaps chime in. So in 2011, the Obama-Clinton administration announced in the fall what they called a pivot to Asia, which was a radical change in U.S. grand strategy. Throughout its history, the U.S. had been a Europe first nation. Now they said Asia would be America's first external priority, with a first claim on U.S. resources and attention. And we believe the Obama administration was strategically correct in 2011. We say why, and we can go into detail about that. The pivot never happened. And there are a variety of reasons, again, I'm sure we'll discuss. But we think that this lost decade, which of course generated the title of our book, is one of the three most serious foreign policy mistakes since the end of the Second World War. And what we try to do in the book is catalog how the pivot came about, what its aspirations were, and the innumerable reasons why it failed and the consequences of why it failed. And particularly the consequences in correlation and simultaneous with what we call the astonishing rise of Chinese power during the decade of the 2010s. So much so was that Chinese power astonishingly making inroads in our national interest, that we emerged from the 2010s and to this day in a weaker position in Asia in every dimension, military, diplomatic, and economic, than we were in when the pivot was announced in 2011. And finally, Eric, the theme of the book is not pessimistic. It doesn't lead to a strategic pessimism. We can still pivot. We have the resources with our allies to respond adequately. We're behind by more than a decade, but it's not too late. And we end the book with the call for the United States to finally not only say that our generational challenge is China, but as a global power, to act as if it is a generational challenge to American national interests while protecting our national interests in other theaters.
Could I just ask a question to for our listeners? First, again, welcome both. They've both been friends and colleagues for a long time. In fact, I remember a grizzled Ambassador Blackwell taking a brand new assistant professor, Cohen, under his wing when he was first at Harvard. Could you just give, for the benefit of the listeners, our listeners, a baseline of what it would have looked like if there had been a real pivot? So just so we know, I mean, in a way you're describing something that didn't happen. If it had happened, what would it have looked like?
Elliot, I thought you were going to refer to a grizzled graduate student who tried to struggle into your 8 a.m. class.
Well, there's that too, isn't there?
So, look, if there had been a pivot to Asia, there would be greater military capability, U.S. and allied military capability in the Indo-Pacific, and therefore greater deterrence. You would not have seen, at least to the same degree, the slide in the military balance away from the United States and its allies that we have seen for a number of years now. You would have seen the U.S. entry in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which was an economic cornerstone, which would have had the effect of giving some countries more options in terms of market access than China, but also had a strategically important signaling effect about U.S. economic leadership in the area. You would have seen sustained U.S. diplomatic activity rather than kind of some of the ups and downs that we have seen over the years in a region where that is important. And you would have seen, before we have seen, some of the steps that we've taken sort of belatedly with respect to what now is called de-risking and some of the other things with Chinese economic interaction. So these are all things that are now trying to be put in place. The current administration is sort of has been what the major exception of trade has been kind of scrambling to catch up on the posture front, on the capabilities front, on diplomacy, on all these other kinds of things. But, you know, many of these things were actually envisioned for the first time at the beginning of the 2010s.
Richard and Bob, could you, you know, explain why the pivot failed? Bob mentioned that at the tail end of his opening remarks this afternoon. You have an excellent list, and I mean, it ought to be actually required reading for graduate students, you know, in policy courses to understand why things fail. I mean, a lot of times it's harder to make a policy work than it is to obstruct it or make it fail. But could you walk through all the reasons that you have uncovered about why this, you know, what would seem on the face of it, absolutely self-explanatory change of direction for U.S. policy didn't turn out to be self-executing, I guess I would put it.
Well, let me take the first shot at that. And we go into, as you said, considerable detail. So I'll just be epigrammatic. And we could talk about each one of these in turn, but I'll just list them essentially. First, this initiative was under-resourced before it was unveiled. There was a very weak interagency process which produced it. And second, there was no consultation with allies before it occurred. So it came as a shock to allies. And I think all of us who have been practitioners understand that our initiatives are likely to be better in their effect if they're coordinated with the allies before we launch them. Next, Washington persistently underestimated the China challenge. It really was only at the end of the 2010s that the Trump administration finally announced through its strategic documents that China was a major power competitor, which didn't wish us well. When the pivot was launched and through much of the 2010s, there was still the vain hope on the part of administrations that we could persuade China to become a responsible stakeholder in the international system. And long after it was clear that was not China's intent, we kept that aspiration. Next, crises emerged in other places. Hillary Clinton said the wars in 2011 were winding down in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and of course they didn't. There was no articulate, commonly understood strategic articulation of what the pivot was supposed to be and was supposed to accomplish. When we interviewed most of the principal architects of that, policy architects of that administration, each one had a different view of that central question of what is the pivot and what is it meant to accomplish. Then no American president put sufficient weight behind the pivot. And with such a enormous change in grand strategy, it seemed unlikely that it was going to get underway in any significant form without presidential leadership. And this is an issue we discuss at length too, there is the issue of whether any American administration can execute a grand strategic shift in the absence of forcing events or cataclysm. And I'm sure we'll talk about that. And then finally, maybe this most simplest reason of all is just no administration in office during this period, including the Biden administration, has found it possible to bring the entire government to work as a first priority the pivot to make Asia the most important of our strategic objectives. It just was too much for them, for any of them to manage.
Well, just to add a couple little to Bob's sort of parade of horribles. I mean, one of the things that really struck me as we looked at this is none of the reasons Bob gave and none of the reasons I'm about to give are because people oppose the pivot or they oppose the idea, oppose the policy, the strategic impulse, whatever you want to call it. And on the contrary, this is one of the very few things the Obama administration articulated that got widespread support, Republicans, Democrats, stinkers, Congress, everything else. And it was other things unrelated often to the pivot that precluded its full implementation. So, for example, the idea was to have more military capability in the Indo-Pacific. That's great. But the Budget Control Act went into place and you had sequestration and you had a $500 billion hit to the defense budget. So the military came out and said, well, we'll put 60% of our Air Force and Navy in the Indo-Pacific. That's great. But it was 60% of a shrinking Navy. So you had less capability than you would have had otherwise. On the trade side, by putting off the TPP and its attempted approval to an election year in 2016, you had the two candidates on both sides in the presidential race come out in opposition to it and couldn't get it through Congress. Again, it had nothing to do with the importance of Asia or the pivot. It had to do with our own trade policy, trade politics changing. And then, of course, you had different people doing different diplomatic jobs. So you had Hillary Clinton, who spent a lot of time going off to Asia. But then when John Kerry became Secretary of State, he spent his first year trying to get a Middle East peace agreement and then spent a lot of time after that with the, trying to get a deal with the Russians on Syria. So there were these opportunity costs based on different priorities and events in the world.
So let me ask a follow-on on that. Just one, my little personal footnote. I don't know if this happened to you, Eric. I remember the administration reaching out during the election year in 2016 to say, would you be willing to try to help lobby Republicans to get TPP passed? And, when you ask them, why the hell are you waiting until now when it's almost guaranteed to fail? There was just hand waving. So, but here's my question to you. The parade of horribles includes some things that are either structural or you don't really blame people for, crises elsewhere. Well, crises are unpredictable. No forcing events. That's an issue I might want to come to later on. The difficulty of mobilizing the government. Okay, those things are all understandable. They would afflict anybody. But when I go through the list that the two of you just mentioned, no consultation with allies, inadequate resourcing, underestimation of the Chinese challenge, not as though there weren't people out there beating the drum about this, no articulation of what the pivot really is, plus things like what I just mentioned. It just sounds like flat out incompetence.
Before you answer, I want to add one thing, which is our late former colleague, Ash Carter, deserves, I think, some credit for during his tenure at the end of the Obama administration of trying to talk about the return of great power competition and that being a important issue for the Department of Defense. And for his troubles, he was sort of slapped down by the then National Security Advisor, who told him to please pipe down and not talk about this anymore. So I think there were some folks trying to deal with some of the issues that you've raised, but it, I think, underscores the point that Bob made about the slowness of people to come around to understanding the world we were in.
By the way, just one last thing, and then I promise we'll actually let you talk. As I listen to you and you lay out what's essentially an indictment of the Obama administration, to some extent Bush, to some extent Trump, but mainly the Obama administration, this does sound like the revenge of the blob.
I'm not quite sure what to do with that last line, but let me say on the issue of competence. Well, we know all these people, and they're good people, and they do their best. But what we try to show in the book is, and we don't have any grand condemnation of individuals. But at the same time, we don't think that the United States is genetically incompetent. And so it does come down to, well, who's the president and who are the principal people who work for him and how did they do? And it's a very sorry story, not just, let me just say, not just in the Obama-Clinton administration. The rhetoric was much improved during the Trump administration, but the performance was not much improved. And so there, those 4 years, we continued to lose ground. And then you had, especially on the trade side and on the diplomatic side, Trump's deeply erratic behavior, which further complicated the movement to the pivot. So I think there's plenty of blame to go around, and we document that without personal accusations. But one last thing, which is when we interviewed these people, and many of them are our friends, and many of them hold high offices in this administration, as we know, and asked them these pointed questions, with some exceptions, they recognized that they fell short. They recognized they fell short, but of course, they had explanations. And it's important, I think, to say that, and we make this point in the book, that we don't, let's not overly concentrate on the military balance, although it deteriorated substantially. As we all know, the quality of diplomacy over time has an enormous effect on American persuasive power. And we have a chapter on the Middle East and a chapter on, you know, on Europe and during this period. And it certainly does not catalog exemplary American diplomatic skill. So each of the major components of our power was weakened, but much of it was self-inflicted. Much of it was self-inflicted. We eroded our power and our prestige and our influence in the Middle East. We didn't want to go into many details, but in the Middle East, we had two presidents who drew red lines and then did not react when the adversary crossed the red lines, both the Syrians and the Iranians. We did virtually nothing to respond to the 2014 Russian annexation of Crimea, which certainly must have had an effect on his calculations in 2022 and so forth. So this is a decade of diplomatic failure in addition to the others.
Yeah, the only thing I guess I would add to that is, you know, I think there were some misjudgments that cost more than others, right? So in 2011, the withdrawal of the last American troops from Iraq, and I guess sort of a crude definition of the pivot where, you know, Asia is really all that matters and all we're doing in the Middle East is sort of wasting our time and resources, that would have been justifiable. But it was widely predicted at the time, as it came to be, that Iraq couldn't survive intact and as a functioning system without some residual troop presence. And of course, we went back in 2015 with in far greater numbers than would have been required had we just stayed with the residual troop presence to conduct a 5-year, very resource intensive counter ISIS campaign, which inevitably took resources away that could have been applied in Asia. Now, if you're in the Obama administration, you say, well, okay, but why did it matter that we pulled troops out of Iraq 8 years after the war began in 2003? Well, that was an inheritance from Bush. So, I mean, there's, you know, you can go around about this, but there were certainly errors of judgment, including ones that were foreseen at the time that I think really affected what we were able to accomplish or lack thereof.
Let me just chime in, if I could just say one other, which is the irony, especially in the Middle East, was that we did not pivot. We had the same forces in the Middle East at the end of the decade and in the 2010s. So no pivot, but the nations of the Middle East concluded we were pivoting. So the announcement accelerated the conviction in the Middle East that America was going home. So the worst of both worlds. You announce the pivot, you don't pivot, but the nations think that that speech and its basic enduring philosophy behind it is American policy. The United States is going home, and that emboldened the Iranians, made our friends there more suspicious about American staying power and all the rest.
Well, that actually precipitates kind of the next kind of question I had for the two of you. I mean, you both talk about the trade-offs involved in prioritizing the Indo-Pacific as opposed to some of the other places where we've been without, at the same time, withdrawing from those places, as Ambassador Blackwell was just suggesting. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. There are a couple of issues, I think, that you know spring from that. One is, there is a school of thought that both of you have kind of touched on, mostly associated publicly with Bridge Colby and sometimes with Senator Josh Hawley, that the United States should only concentrate on East Asia. It should just forget about, let Europeans, you know, defend themselves. They're rich countries, they can defend themselves. And, you know, we've done enough in the Middle East, we should let others, you know, take care of that. You obviously in this book are arguing against that, but I wonder if you'd like to just talk a little bit about why you think a sole concentration on East Asia and the Indo-Pacific won't work. The other thing you talk about is the need to, manage drawdown of resources by, as Ambassador Blackwell was saying, adroit diplomacy. So one thing that this current administration is doing is now pursuing a deal in the Middle East, which would involve the Secretary of State. Just in the green room before we came on, Ambassador Blackwell and I were talking about the fact Tony Blinken's just about to, or already has just shown up in the Middle East after the National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan was there last week. They're pursuing this, what I would describe as the diplomatic equivalent of a three-rail billiard shot, which is a peace treaty or defense treaty with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, which would presumably only win support from the United States Senate if it was coupled with a rapprochement between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and Israel and normalization of relations. That in turn only seems to be able to be accomplished if the administration is able to secure some kind of ceasefire in Gaza and a commitment by the probably the most right-wing government we've ever had in Israel in its history to a path towards a two-state solution and the Palestinian state, along with some self-denying agreements with the Saudis not to let the Chinese build bases there or to get in bed with the Chinese. And also, oh, by the way, a nuclear 1-2-3 agreement on nuclear cooperation that will allow the Saudis to pursue nuclear power, but presumably without actually proliferating and developing their own nuclear weapons. So how likely do you think any of this is, and how does that fit into what you were discussing in terms of trying to reassure allies while also drawing down military resources to try and refocus them on the Indo-Pacific?
Just on your first question, there is a sort of new version of what I guess I just described as sort of the crude pivot, which is really the United States should be a regional power focused first and foremost, and to the exclusion of lots of other things, on Asia because China is so menacing and so important. And so essentially any increment of resources, time, or attention that is dispensed in places like Europe and to some degree in the Middle East is wasted because it's being denied from the priority theater. And that's not particularly dangerous to ignore these other theaters because, after all, we have friendly locals in Europe and the Middle East who've got money and capability and can sort of step up and sort things out on their own. I think there's a couple of problems with that approach. One is, one is this thing called history. Whereas if you look at, for example, in Europe, the European ability to defend itself since 1945 has never been complete without U.S. assistance. And if you look at things that ultimately matter to Americans and to Europeans. So, for example, when ISIS built the world's biggest caliphate in the Middle East and destabilized that region, was inspiring and planning attacks in Europe, it was more of a threat to Europe than it was to the United States. But until the United States led the counter-ISIS campaign, there was no European campaign stepping in, nor was there any Middle East campaign that sort of indigenously kind of came up and beat them back. It required the United States. So the reality is we have interests and commitments in both Europe and the Middle East. We're not a regional power. So to say that Asia is the preeminent region doesn't mean it's the only one. But the other thing is there are interconnections between what happens in one region, what happens the other. I mean, so for example, if the United States were to say, well, look, we've had enough of this supporting Ukraine, that's dollars and capabilities wasted that could be better given to the Taiwanese or to, you know, our own forces or something like that, then the lesson to the next would-be aggressor, potentially including China, would be, well, you can just wait out the West, no matter what they say about how long they're committed to this. And you don't have to take our word for the interconnections. The Taiwanese themselves say that. So do the Japanese, the Australians, the South Koreans. Everyone in the region is pushing against an exclusive focus on Asia to the exclusion of American commitments in other places. So the reality is we have to pivot to Asia, but we have to do so in a way that is responsible and takes into account the fact that we are and will remain a global power.
I'm going to ask the same sort of question, but from two different directions. Let me start with the first direction, which is the more pessimistic, or you might even consider defeatist side, which is on the military side. And I take Bob's point about don't underestimate diplomacy. But still, I mean, the military part of this is crucial. And, you know, it seems to me when you think about the combination of Chinese commitment, particularly under a dictator who has more power really than any other Chinese leader since Mao, the advantages of geography, and above all, the advantages of tremendous industrial capacity of a kind that just people don't fully appreciate how, you know, the extent to which the Chinese have now, I think it's like seven large shipyards, each of which can produce as much as we can produce. I mean, they have invested, they've had a lot of money, and they've invested it in maritime and military production. And, you know, what some, this may even be the argument of some of our colleagues who are not involved in the pivot, think a little bit of Graham Allison, I suppose. We just say, hey, look, it's hopeless. You know, they are bound to assert more and more power along their periphery. It was historically anomalous that the United States Navy could dominate the South China Sea and the East China Sea. So, you know, much better to accommodate. I don't believe any of that. I just want to throw it out there for you guys to react to.
Bob, do you want to
take
that on, or I can try to swat that down?
Well, go ahead.
Well, look, it's not hopeless. It's not hopeless for a whole variety of reasons. One, because the underlying strength of the American economy, which still is the biggest in the world, let's not forget. And actually, Chinese GDP as a share of U.S. GDP has actually declined for the last couple of years. So, you know, those who sort of write America's, sort of geopolitical obituary, at least in Asia, I think are highly premature. The other is we've got allies. And so we've got sort of the latent capacity and capability. The Chinese are sort of way out in front in areas, Elliot, that you described. And that's one of the reasons why we sort of refer to a lost decade from which we're kind of hardly trying to catch up and still only partially doing so. But you do see things happening just in the past couple of years that previously would have been impossible on the posture front, on, you know, even some of the appropriations for shipbuilding and things like that. Now, I would like to see a lot more of that, but you weren't seeing any of that a couple of years ago. And so things, I think, are moving. And this question, the real question is, in my mind, and we sort of touched on this, is can we look ahead to what would be necessary for us to maintain our strategic position in Asia and do the things in advance or now that are necessary? Or do we need a crisis to force our hand where we say, oh my God, the Chinese just attacked Taiwan, or pick whatever sort of crisis thing you need. And then we rush as a political system and with our allies in sort of a Russia attacked Ukraine fashion to try to deal with the situation. And I think it's our hope that, you know, if you can anticipate some of this enough, that you can actually get ahead of that and hopefully deter that kind of thing in the first place.
Elliot, if I can also address the question, of course, this is a tough problem now in 2024, the military balance across the straits. It's a tough problem. And the United States, for the foreseeable future, will have a very tough time if it engages militarily to defend Taiwan. I'm now not suggesting one way or another whether we should, but if we do, we'll have a tough time. But surely that doesn't lead to appeasement, because appeasement only leads to the next problem, which is worse than the one you had when you appeased. So the clarion call in the book is to do much more about the problems you ticked off. And that is already having some success by the Biden administration, more success because of Chinese policies, which are alarming virtually every country in Asia, as we know, and what's happened to the Japanese defense budget and its willingness to project power has been dramatic, as we know. The last point, though, is that I think we would all agree that a war between the United States and China would be a global catastrophe. And being a Kissingerian, as I am, then he would say, all right, well, what's the diplomacy and what's the deterrence to avoid the catastrophe? And we are trying to strengthen deterrence now in the way that we've described earlier with the allies and the measures that Richard just mentioned. But there's no diplomacy between the United States and China to avoid the Taiwan catastrophe. And both sides now go to meetings at the highest level and repeat the talking points, while both sides challenge the fundamentals of the One China policy. We have to remember, and I know we all do, that the One China policy most fundamentally was based on mutual restraint. Here's the deal. China will not use military force against Taiwan, and the United States will not encourage Taiwan to independence. That's the deal, though that's the mutual restraint. Well, we have a situation today in which China's military pressure on Taiwan is the greatest ever, and the United States is strengthening every dimension of U.S. bilateral support for Taiwan, military, economic, and diplomatic. So the One China framework is not helping avoid the catastrophe. And so maybe there's a better framework. But to have a policy where you if you accept that a war between the United States and China would be cataclysmic for the United States, then presumably there is both deterrence and diplomacy, which reduces the likelihood that that will happen. And as I said, and to repeat it, that there are now efforts, thank goodness, on strengthening deterrence, but diplomacy is absent between the two in any serious way about how to avoid the catastrophe.
So let me press you a bit. I agreed with everything Richard and Bob, you both said until that point. And it's really, you know, more in regret than anything else. And it seems to me that the fundamental dimension of this is what's happening in China. In a certain way, it's not so much about us. I mean, the Central American conceit is always, it's all about us. And it seems to me, you know, the more I read about contemporary China, you know, we've got a problem with a autocratic leader who is aging, who sees himself as having a historic mission, who is prone to make some bad decisions. And I think we've underestimated the extent to which he's made some terrible economic decisions. He made some terrible decisions, I think, during COVID. But who is absolutely hell-bent on incorporating Taiwan in the way that they incorporated Hong Kong. And, you know, I wish I thought there was some clever diplomatic formula or, you know, extraordinarily adroit interactions. You know, we have Nick Burns, who we all know, who's our ambassador to Beijing, is a very talented diplomat. I think Tony Blinken actually is, as Secretary of State goes, pretty good. I'm not sure diplomacy can fix that. And I, as I said, I say that with regret. And what it reflects, Bob, is actually more my, in a way, my pessimism, not about the eventual outcome, because I think China's weaknesses are as great or greater than its strengths, but it's just, I'm not sure that I'm really seeing clear ways out of this. Maybe Eric, you should chime in. I don't know whether you agree with me on this or not.
Well, I guess, you know, I would just say that to me, diplomacy and deterrence are really go hand in hand. I'm fond of citing George Kennan's 1946 lecture to the National War College, where he said, you have no idea how much more polite and constructive diplomacy is if you have a little quiet military power in the background, I guess, is what I would say. So given the fact that Bob and Richard in the book describe a seriously deteriorating military balance in the region, it doesn't altogether surprise me that our diplomatic interactions with the Chinese amount to a kind of periodic exchange of unpleasantries, which is what, you know, what I think we've seen certainly over the last couple of years, but maybe even for longer than that. So I guess to me, the question becomes, how do we, you know, improve the prospects for diplomacy by improving the military balance that maybe injects a little bit more caution into the Chinese side than right now they're displaying. And so to me, that gets at the question that you call in the book for significant increase in defense spending. I guess for me, it's a really big question, because right now we are about to slip below 3% of GDP devoted to defense. And when you think of the scale of the challenge that you describe correctly, in my view, in the book, it's something that Bob Gates has said is the biggest challenge we've faced since 1945. Yeah, I think you refer to his foreign affairs article in the book. We see a intensifying collaboration between China and Russia that is making use of some of these productive capacities that China has developed in a way that is extremely problematic for us and is fueling Russia's ability to wage the biggest war on the European continent since 1945. All of that suggests that, you know, we need to be thinking about, you know, a defense expenditure on a much larger scale than we have heretofore thought about. I mean, we thought, you know, at the beginning of the Trump administration, President Trump likes to say, I fixed defense. I had two years of 3% growth in defense spending. And I think Richard and I can both testify, you know, from our service on the Defense Policy Board, that bought us back a little bit of readiness, which was really seriously deteriorating, but it certainly hasn't solved the problem. So I'd be interested in the two of you giving a sense of, like, given the scale of this, how big a, you know, defense buildup do we need in order to empower, you know, and underwrite the kind of diplomacy that Ambassador Blackwell recommends, and which I, you know, agree with in principle.
Well, let me take the first part of it, and then perhaps Richard the second. Elliot, the book is a ringing agreement with how you characterized the current Chinese president. And we have an entire chapter on exactly that subject. And I think your hell-bent, well, if that has an immediacy to it, I don't think that's probably true in the next several months. But he is determined, absolutely, to bring Taiwan back to his definition of the motherland. So there's no doubt about that. The whole point of negotiation, I think Madeleine Albright said once that trying to come to an agreement with an adversary who presents a danger to you was known in history as diplomacy. And so the question is there any room for diplomacy given what Eric just said, and which I also wholly agree to. So here's a parlor game for all of us, perhaps, which is this. So let's imagine we have built, at least to some degree, strengthened our deterrent capability with our allies, which is not an afterthought. It's a crucial element of same. And let's imagine that we're now trying to reintroduce restraint on the two sides. Agreements with adversaries require compromises. So here's the parlor game for you, Elliot, which is, well, what compromises would you be willing to make with respect to current U.S. policy toward Taiwan, if it could stabilize the relationship but not jeopardize vital American national interests? And if the answer is none, because we're right in principle that the people of Taiwan should be able to choose their form of government and so forth, and of course that's a perfectly respectable view, if that's your view. But if that's the view of the two sides, we're heading to war with China. We are precisely for the reason, Elliot, that you said, we're heading to war with China. And if that's a catastrophe, surely it's the responsibility of the American president to try to avoid it, And we counsel the first recommendation in the book is to increase substantially the defense budget, as Eric advised, precisely to strengthen our capacity to negotiate. But perhaps you think there's no room, as far in the future as you can see, for any diplomacy with China, and no room for any compromises with China. And if that's your view, it's a free country.
I guess my view is we have already compromised a great deal in terms of our dealings with Taiwan. I think it's very hard for me to see a compromise deal that doesn't involve basically Taiwan becoming part of China and eventually experiencing what Hong Kong has experienced. And it's not just a question of human rights. And maybe here I'm disagreeing with your Kissingerian side, although I think those are very important. And I think throwing away what is a vibrant democracy is a very bad idea for a whole bunch of reasons, but it's about American national interest. And the idea of Taiwan falling under the sway of Beijing, with a very large economy, an extraordinarily advanced economy, with all the implications for our relationships in that part of the world, I think would be catastrophic. I also think that it is a false choice to say, well, if you're not in favor of squeezing Taiwan, then you're in favor of war with China. I think I don't believe that that's necessarily the case, but I do think we're in a very dangerous situation. That's for sure. And I guess the one other thing I don't believe that, you know, if you build up your forces and then you throw away a commitment that you made, you know, more than half a century ago, that your deterrent means much, because deterrence is not simply about the number of B-21s that you have flying, or aircraft carriers or submarines that you have sailing. It's about how the other guy views your strength and your commitment. And I think that's, if after everything that we've done and everything that we've said, we effectively throw Taiwan under the bus, I don't think we have much of a deterrent, even if we have two more aircraft carriers in the Pacific. Just the reverse.
Elliot, if I may say, and then back to Richard, I think when you watch the rerun of this, if you do, you will never encounter me saying, throw Taiwan under the bus. But surely...
What's the compromise that you propose?
Well, that's the parlor game I gave you, right? That is the parlor game. But for example, I'll just give you one example, and it is not reducing U.S. military support to Taiwan. It is not. That is not on the agenda. But for example, do we need to go full bore in congressional trips, beginning with Nancy Pelosi, that have no substantive outcome, as far as I can tell, except to sour even more the relationship with Beijing? Maybe you supported her visit.
I don't know how the president can prevent the Speaker of the House from traveling where she wants to travel.
Well, I say maybe you don't, but I think what you're saying,
it's just not something he can do. I mean, if she wants to go there, she's going to go there.
Well, as I say, this is a conversation perhaps on another point, because I don't want to get derailed from the major themes of the book. Which have to do with what the United States should do and the China we're dealing with and our allies in Europe and the Middle East and so forth. But I would just say that if you believe that there's no place for compromise in our relationship with China regarding U.S. vital national interests, okay. But I believe that is going to lead us into a conflict with China, and not perhaps tomorrow or the next day, but I think we're headed for that unless we can figure out, back to what Eric said, what is the right combination among deterrence and diplomacy. And I believe that diplomacy has a role here. But Richard, you've been patient over there.
Well, I was sort of enjoying this debate that you two are having. The one thing I would point out is none of this is actually in the book, really. So we sort of endorse diplomacy, but we don't have a concept by which the United States and China would somehow work things out over Taiwan and what that would mean for the Taiwanese or anything like that. And I'm actually quite pessimistic that on these big structural differences between the United States and China, and I would put Taiwan in that there is you know, sort of a grand compromise to be had. And I also agree that it would be catastrophic if China were to get a hold of Taiwan through conquest or some other nefarious means, including our own capitulation. So diplomacy, good. It's good to have diplomacy. But, you know, to understand the limits of what diplomacy is able to achieve is obviously part of the equation as well.
What about the defense budget? You, we had the, Eric's good question about the defense budget, and is this realistic? We've had some critics say about the defense budget, yes, it's absolutely necessary, and there's no possibility of what you propose. But Richard, is there?
I mean, spending doesn't seem to be the government's problem. It's what we are spending money on. I mean, last I checked, we had no possibility of actually bringing receipts in line with expenditures. So it's how you're apportioning that big pie. And if you look at how we're apportioning that big pie, I mean, I think Eric alluded to this, but you know, we're about as a percentage of GDP spending on defense where we were in about 1999, the height of the peace dividend after the end of the Cold War. We're not that far off from where we were in 1953, the peace dividend after the end of the Korean War, except that this there's no peace out there. You know, we've got a raging war in Europe. We've got major issues and a raging war in the Middle East. And we have a region in Asia, which is geographically challenging, and in which we all seem to agree that America's greatest long-term competitor is most active and its military power is most acute in that theater. So add it all together, and the idea that the defense budget, I mean, at least for this year compared to last year, in a real decrease, and in sort of overall historical sense as you know, near a low, doesn't make a lot of sense. We need to have a significant increase in it. And there's one striking chart that we included in this book. You can go back, look at, for example, naval power. So about 20 years ago, we have a chart. The United States had about 150 more ships than China did. Now, China has about 150 more ships than we do. Well, that's pretty consequential in a maritime theater. And so if you'd like to do something about that, you work with allies, got it. We do all of those things. But at the end of the day, iron in the water matters and capability matters, and that costs money. And so you need not only to apportion a slice of the military pie for Asia, but have an overall larger one.
Could I just add to that, just drawing on that and on our conversation so far, if we know what should be done to deal with this astonishing rise of Chinese power, and there's broad bilateral support for the measures that need to be done, they're not, by and large, being done. We have no trade policy for Asia. Our diplomacy is now devoted almost entirely to Europe and the Middle East. And we've just talked about the military balance. Whether we're able to respond to this is a test of how serious a country we are.
I think that's a note, of agreement.
Yeah. Well, I think we've mostly agreed during this this talk, this chat.
I absolutely agree with that, Bob. And I think that note of agreement, since we're running short on time, and I know Elliot's got another engagement, probably brings us to an end of this episode of Shield of the Republic, but I really want to thank the two of you for first writing this book, which I think is an important one, and for taking the time to talk with us about it today.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.